Hello, everybody. Welcome back to A Few Minutes of History. I'm your host, Jake, and today I am joined by Ian Pegg. Ian, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm great, thank you very much. And how are you, Jake?
I'm not too bad. I'm on night shift this week, so I'm a little bit dishevelled, as you could probably tell by my appearance. but I'm all right in the sort of general scheme of things. I'm very excited to talk about today's topic, and today's topic will be chaplains, and in particular, chaplains and their role in the Second World War. Ian, before we jump into that, why don't you give us a little bit of who you are, what you do, and how you came on to research such an interesting topic that I think is, if certainly in my experience, a bit under the radar.
Well, thank you. So who am I? That's a good question. I'm somebody who got back into the military history and history of conflict during lockdown. I think because a lot of us did it, we were looking to keep us entertained. And I think we all have had relatives who fought in the First and the Second World War, and we've heard the stories. And I certainly had a grandfather who fought in the Second World War. He wasn't religious. He wasn't a padre. He was a Royal Engineer. But you get bits of his story, and I regret not asking him lots of questions. And through that interest and through finding it online and various podcasts, I read a book called Thank You, Padre, about padres in the Second World War. And I got interested by the fact, and we'll come on to this, my question is always, why would a man go to war, not pick up weapons, have complete faith in their religion, and belief that they are there to serve their fellow men, put themselves in perilous situations, and at times sacrifice their lives for other men? And that question always is at the back of my mind as I do this. Who are they? And it's not, I don't want to talk about the theory of religion and is war right in religion. This is about their story, the men. What was the background? Why did they do what they do? What did they experience? How did it affect them? And that they were my big questions, and that's what's got me really interested. And then the more you dig into this and the more you look at the detail, the more you find some incredible stories of bravery, the stories of people putting their lives on the line to protect others, and giving up their freedom at times to be captured, to serve in prison of war camps and things like that.
Now, that's really interesting. You know, you make some really good points there. It's, you know, you hear the stories of people volunteering to join up because, you know, they think it's the right thing to do and they want to fight the enemy and bring freedom. But you make a really interesting point there. You know, what motivates someone to join up, not to fight the enemy, but to always bring comfort to those who are fighting and give a different perspective on, you know, conflict. That's a really interesting sort of point. And, you know, and I think it's you don't have to be a religious person to sort of respect, you know, what they did or, you know, wonder why they did it. I think it's an incredibly brave thing that these guys did, you know, to go to these places and effectively to, like you said, you know, put their lives on the line and sometimes give up their lives to bring comfort to those that need it in their time of crisis.
And I think people need to recognize that even though they were chaplains, it's more than just about religion. A chaplain's role wasn't just about giving spiritual guidance and giving service. It was about morale. And as we will talk about, their role developed throughout the war to be many things to all men. So they would be stretcher bearers, they would be fetching wounded from the front line, they would be manning regimental aid posts, they would be writing letters to bereaved, writing letters for men, they would be that confidant if a person was struggling, a soldier was struggling, a person they could talk to. And they were respected by all. There was some doubt at the start of the war from commanding officers about what are we going to do with this chaplain. We don't know why he's here, to ultimate respect. And I think what's really important is when you get somebody like Montgomery, and there's a great quote from Montgomery that said, this was given at the All Saints Cathedral in Cairo, "I would soonest think of going into battle without my artillery as without my chaplains." For Montgomery, and we've got to remember, Montgomery was the son of a bishop who he thought Christian values and patriotism went hand in hand. And he believed that the soldiers, though tough, though well-trained, needed that spiritual guidance. And it became much more than just spirit.
Mm-hmm. No, that's... So
that's
an interesting point. You know, you definitely make there. And I think having sort of the backing of someone like Monty as well, that, you know, that's a great deal for what these guys did, because, you know, like you said, this, it's very easy for, say, non-religious people to sort of push them away and go, we don't, you know, why are we taking another mouth to feed, another person that needs looking after, especially one now that can't fight, doesn't have a weapon, etc. But, you know, to have that backing from someone so high ranking, I think that sums them up perfectly for me.
Yeah, and I think we have to remember as well that they are non-combatants.
Mm-hmm.
So under the Geneva Convention and others, they weren't allowed to pick up weapons, or they shouldn't have picked up weapons. There are instances where they did, but 99.9% of the time they were there as a non-combatant, and recognized by all sides as that.
Mm. I think that's a good point to make as well. You know, that I think that just adds to the story. You know, being a non-combatant and not, we'll come on to it later, but things like D-Day and things like that, landing on those beaches with just your faith, effectively.
I think that's a really interesting point, that all they had were their religious vestments,
mm-hmm,
and their faith and nothing else, and their belief in themselves.
Absolutely. Ian, let's sort of rewind from the Second World War and sort of go to the beginning. So when was the Army Chaplaincy Corps, or the Royal Army Chaplaincy Corps, I believe it is called now, when was that sort of formed, and why was that formed at that sort of time period?
Right, if we go right back in history, so clergy has been going to war since 1066, effectively. Mm. Senior leaders, commanders would take their own religious person, chaplain, vicar, reverend, whatever you wish to call them, into battle with them. And they performed many roles apart from religion, because they came from educated backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
They were used as diplomats. They were used as spies at times. But it was very ad hoc. In 1796, the Army Chaplains Department was formed under its first Chaplain General, and it was to try and bring some uniformity and recognition that spiritual guidance was needed for war. But I think it wasn't recognised for the value it could have, and I think that came to the fore in the Crimean War, where there was one deployable chaplain for 26,000 troops.
Wow.
You can imagine how overwhelming that could be, and the role of, and what that chaplain did. And that was the Reverend Henry Press Wright. But what was interesting from that was that, that there was a report done in the Times, that caused, I just need to get this name right, the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel to recognize this need and finance more chaplains. Now, this wasn't financed from government. This was a separate organization. Mm-hmm. And they eventually deployed 60 more chaplains, and of which 12 died in the Crimean War. So that was where we got to there. And then if we fast forward through to the First World War, the Great War, it started to be recognized that there were a really important role for chaplains to take place. And there's quite an interesting synergy in that in the Great War, the First World War, there were about 3,450 chaplains that served. And at the start of the war, there were only 100 full-time chaplains. So there was certainly a ramp up in that war.
Yeah, definitely.
And then if you look at those figures compared to the Second World War, they're about the same. There were over 3,650 chaplains in the Second World War that eventually served. But at the start of the Second World War in 1939, there were only 120 full-time chaplains and 100 territorial army chaplains at the start of the Second World War. And with war being declared and we could see what was coming. There was an immediate emergency commission of 400 chaplains that happened within months.
Wow.
Now, it up to 1920 was the Army Chaplains Department, but King George recognised the service that had been taking place in World War One and gave it its royal moniker. And that was, I believe, in about 1920 that happened. And then that takes us into the start of the Second World War and the build-up of chaplains and their role from the Phoney War and in Dunkirk and then through the war. And they served in all fields across the whole battlefield in World War II. So it's not just them doing it. They were on the front line with their battalions in every battle that took place.
That was one of the questions I was going to ask. So when they deployed, was it, you know, battalion level, regimental level? How did that sort of work? Or was it, you know, did they have enough chaplains? So, you'd split your time between the two, or was it whoever was getting deployed got a chaplain? Is that sort of how it worked? Or
Yes and no. What we have to remember is that there were chaplains from all denominations.
Hmm.
Now, a chaplain's role, though they would be predominantly serving with soldiers from their own religion, yeah, is to minister to whoever comes to them, no matter what religion they are. So though they may, I think the figure is about 70%, they would be expected to serve about 70% of their own religion and then whoever else is around. Now, the issue you come to there is, for example, there were only two Jewish chaplains at the start of the Second World War.
Yeah.
And how do two Jewish chaplains spread themselves across the whole of the BEF, especially in Dunkirk? Mm. What you did find, and this was in all theatres, chaplains served at battalion level, they served at regimental level. It depends on numbers and the scale, but they would be very mobile. They would have transport, and they were very resourceful in acquiring transport depending on what they needed. And that would be everything from a motorbike to a lorry that they turned into a naffy, that they turned into their mobile church where they could do their services out in the field wherever it was needed at the drop of a hat. So it's a case of they served over a wide range of areas. And at times, they managed to get themselves lost, especially in the desert.
I can imagine.
There are a number of stories of chaplains setting off at night, getting lost, and ending up in places they shouldn't have been. It must have been very difficult because they were certainly resourceful, but they had to have a mind on where they were going and who they were serving and why they were serving.
Now, that's quite interesting. And certainly from my own military experience, the padres and bishops and stuff that I've always met have been for the most part stark raving mad. So getting into a Jeep in the middle of the African desert and just driving around doesn't really surprise me with those guys. So let's start then with sort of Dunkirk and their role there. So what happens when the BEF goes over? Do they just send over a load of chaplains and sort of say, right, you know, go and do your thing? Or is it, you know, a voluntary basis initially? How does that sort of work?
It's the recruitment was interesting in that you would get those that volunteered and those that recognised that they needed service. And you get some that were ordained in 1938 and a year later would volunteer for service. You would get some that were volunteered by their bishop, and they tended
and
to
they
be, yeah, they tended to be the single men who didn't have family attachments, may not have had parish attachments, and it was suggested in the strongest terms that they might like to serve on an emergency commission in the army, and. As far as I can work out, they were just allocated to battalions. Now, the problem there's two problems here. One is a chaplain is classed as an officer, and that is always the case. But there was a real recognition that because they served all men across all officers and the general population, they had to make sure that they were respected by everybody. So they would go out of their way, even though they were officers and they served in the officers' mess, to ingratiate themselves with their fellow soldiers. So they would be in the phony war. They would be doing things like setting up entertainments. They would be running naffies. They would be educating people. They would be doing whatever it took to gain respect from all their soldiers and to show that they were open for everybody.
Yeah.
It needed to be really clear that anybody could come to them at any time and talk to them. And that was really important.
No, yeah, that's, I guess it must be difficult, you know, for those guys joining, say, a battalion, especially at the start of the war, of men that potentially have been together for quite a while, you know, and being sort of almost the foreigner who joins, you know, for a lot of the guys, you know, someone potentially they had no interest in if they weren't religious, and you know, they thought, you know, like I said earlier, another mouth to feed, another person that they have to look after. But I think it's a good way to win men's respect is to you know, set up entertainment and naffies and just be someone to talk to. I think is always a winner especially for the lads. And like you said, they obviously done that because they got, you know, massive amounts of respect, which I think still to this day holds testament how much respect they get in the forces.
I think what we have to remember as well is at the start of the war, they had very little training. Mm. It wasn't until June 1940 that they got 14 days training on what their role was as a chaplain. And it wasn't very clear at the start of the war outside of giving spiritual guidance what their role should be. Commanders didn't really know what to do with them.
Yeah.
The chaplains didn't want to just be seen as somebody who worked on a Sunday. They wanted to be seen as being useful. There was no clear understanding of that extra bit about morale and about welfare and about looking after the soldier. And a lot of the chaplains made it up as they went along. They basically made their role up as they rolled through, even though some of their senior leaders were saying, no, it's only about religion. Well, it had to be more than that because it had to be part of who they were. And that being part of the soldiers. So you move forward to the likes of, there's a famous chaplain who served with, the Chindits, and, Wingate really wanted to make sure that they were, seen as part of the men. So they had to go through exactly the same training. They went through that training with the soldiers. Whatever the soldiers did, the chaplains did. And that really, really cemented their relationship with the soldiers because the soldiers saw that that was the case. And I think all the way through in all my research, the more that the chaplains did things at that level, the more respect that they got from the men. And there are lots of references to chaplains being my best friend, being part of the lads, being involved in what's going off, because they made that effort to ensure that anybody could come to them and they were seen as somebody who wasn't aloof and who was part of the whole, not just part of some of it.
No, that's an interesting point I think you made there about, you know, them training with the Chindits and stuff. I imagine it would have been the same in the parachute regiment when that was a concept, especially, you know, in the Second World War, because it was a new concept for the lads to see that the chaplain could do exactly the same as them, you know, jumps wise, fitness wise, etc. Probably didn't, you know, bring them closer together because, like you said, if you're all as one, then aren't you? And they've done exactly the same as them. A blight without a weapon, but obviously, you know, that doesn't change anything in terms of training and stuff. So it's like I said, it's an easy win for the chaplain. Go on, Ian.
Yeah, and I'm going to give a shout out to another book and another author here that's done some very specific work on airborne chaplains, and that's Linda Parker, who's written a book called Nearer My God to Thee, and that. Mm-hmm. That sets out the role of army chaplains in the parachute regiment. And they had to go through paraschool. They had to gain their wings. They parachuted behind enemy lines on D-Day. They were there with the men at Arnhem. Some died at Arnhem. Some got captured at Arnhem. So it's very much what the soldiers do, the chaplains did. And they were certainly they all went to Paris school and they all did all those sorts of things. And I think that's really, really important that they were prepared to go to those lengths to be part of the Paras, the SAS, the Commandos, and all the other regiments that were involved in that.
No, that's interesting. I've heard of that that book as well. I've not actually read it, but it does sound interesting. And it, like you said, you know, for the lads to see that the chaplain is doing that is a massive morale boost for them, because they know that they're not going to be, you know, stuck behind with the chaplain if they need to, you know, bog out of somewhere. The chaplain can keep up and can effectively do his own thing, which is ideal, which is what they'd want, I imagine.
Yeah, and very much that comes into its own in things like the withdrawal across Belgium and France into Dunkirk. The chaplains were very much involved in that. They were based with medical units, with regimental aid posts. They were walking the distance that the soldiers were walking when they didn't have transport. They were serving the wounded and dealing with stuff on the front line. They were involved in exactly what the soldiers were involved in. They were being bombed on a daily basis. They were holding their services wherever they could with shells flying overhead. And some of them died and some of them were captured. 30 chaplains were actually captured at Dunkirk and BEF, and some of those ended up being in captivity till 1945, it shows that they served with the men and were captured with the men. They didn't try and escape before everybody else.
So when these men were captured at a sort of Dunkirk and, you know, retreating with the BEF, was that, you know, when an aid post was needed to be evacuated and there was injured men, would they, you know, often volunteer to stay behind? And
very much so. They were, this is the unselfish nature of chaplain. Yeah. They were quite prepared to stay behind with the men to be part of the last people out. And that happened all the way through the withdrawal. And even on the beach, you would find the last people off the beach were chaplains. And they would let men go before them, and they would be dealing with the wounded on the beach. And there are a number of citations and awards to chaplains who served on that beach, who were there serving the wounded, who were making sure wounded got on ships first, who were under fire constantly and did not rest. They were seen to work harder than everybody else because they saw it as their duty to serve.
No, that's really interesting. And like you said, it goes to the selfless nature of sort of the role, isn't it? Because,
yeah,
you know, it's how can you sort of, I guess a lot of them probably thought, how can I sort of take up a space on a transport where I can let someone else go and things like that? And I imagine it must have been very hard to volunteer to stay behind, or, you know, when you could potentially have the chance to get away. But it just sort of goes to show what their mindset was and how sort of willing they were and how much they cared about their troopers as well, but with them.
Yeah. And I think it's that, it comes back to that thing I said at the beginning, what drives a man to go to war without arms and to serve those soldiers on the front line. And I think part of that thought process is that unselfish behavior in that it's not about them. It's about the people they serve with. And ultimately, some of them made the ultimate sacrifice in doing that. They would be trying to rescue wounded and they would die having been shot or having been shelled or mortared whilst they were trying to get wounded from the front line or off the beach. And that happened on a number of occasions. I mean, 96, there's a debate about the figure, but 96, there's 96 recognised chaplain deaths, Royal Army chaplain deaths, and 38 Commonwealth chaplain deaths throughout the war. And I think there were 11, if I remember rightly, in 1940, all related to the withdrawal from the beach and others, which is quite interesting. I mean, there are some really sad stories around chaplains that died. And so the first one that died was a chaplain called Reverend Podmore, and he was attached to 3 Corps. As his unit moved around Belgium, he was he was trying to get from one place to another to pick some stuff up, and he came upon a German advanced unit who shot his car up, and he was shot in the legs, and he was left bleeding at the side of the road, just left bleeding. The Germans would not treat him. Now, what's interesting with this story is that French civilians from a nearby house came out to help, and one brave family in particular took the padre into their house, and they hid his vestments and personal effects. But he died later on that day, and the SS commander, who sounds a bit of a git, sorry I said that out loud, but was all for imprisoning the men of the house. But the head of the family was the local mine manager, and the mine went on strike, and the Germans needed the mine, so they had to release him. But you have to look at the danger that family went through.
Yeah, absolutely.
Recognized a chaplain that needed help, and that was recognized right across the piece. So he was the first chaplain to die. And there's lots of stories around chaplains that died in really sad circumstances like that.
I can imagine it is potentially, you know, a lot of them died or were captured. You know, just like you said, you know, getting into a vehicle and driving unit to unit, often, you know, if you get lost, it's very easy to slip behind the German lines and get picked up and stuff. So it does, you know, it takes some real bravery to just sort of do that.
Yeah.
You know, it's no surprise that so many were captured or killed while just traveling around, you know.
No, once they were captured, and some actually deliberately were captured, they recognized that the men who were injured would need help. So where they could have escaped, they didn't. They tried to, they deliberately got captured and then were put in prisoners of war camps across Germany and Italy, from depends on which battlefront they were formed in. And there was a real, I think there was a real battle in camps, because they were officers. They tended to be billeted with the officers. And then there was a big argument about they should be serving all the men.
Yeah.
And, I believe, because they were classed as non-combatants, they technically shouldn't have been prisoners of war. But that's a whole other.
It's a debate.
Debate
on its own, I think,
that's
isn't it?
That's not for here. But as prisoners of war, they would be not just dealing with their own sense of loneliness, their own sense of boredom, in some extent, but they would be friend to everybody in the camp. They would be dealing with all the issues. They would be writing letters for soldiers that may not have been able to write. They would be talking to the commanders of the camps to get extra supplies where they were needed. And they became very resourceful in getting things as prisoners of war. And it depends where they were based. So there's a whole different story about prisoners of war in Japan and how poorly they were treated, what happened there. But certainly in Europe, they were also certainly not against transferring information between camps. So at some point in the war, they were allowed to travel between camps to give religion. And as part of traveling between camps, they would be taking information with them. They would be sharing parts to radios that they would carry in their vestments. They would get stopped on a number of occasions by German officers wondering who they were and what they were. But that being a chaplain allowed them a little bit of freedom in Europe. It's not quite the same in Japan and in the Far East, but it is really interesting. There was one famous chaplain in Colditz who got locked up there because he was good at eliciting information where he shouldn't be eliciting information, amongst many things. But in Japan, it was completely different. So if you think about the Far East, Singapore at Changi, one of the largest prisoner of war camps, 11,000, I think. So you would have a number of chaplains from all religions in there. And it was a completely different way of being a prisoner of war. They would set up churches from scratch, but it would be more than that. It would be about setting up education classes. It would be about dealing with people's worries. And as food got less, as they were treated poorly, the amount of burials they would be undertaking on a daily basis from
soldiers
that had died from illness, from malnutrition. And these were men that they would know and serve with, and they would have got to know over time. And I always, they would also be the person that buried these men. And how did that affect them?
That's an interesting part that I didn't actually think about, was, you know, the burial and having to do, you know, those sorts of jobs as well, because weirdly during war, I didn't think about it, but it makes perfect sense, you know, having to do their ministerial duties as well as, you know, burial parties and things like that. Cause obviously, you know, they would have been front and center for that, because that, you know, is part of their job in civilian life as well as in the military. So,
and those burial parties weren't just for prisoners of war, although that was, it did happen there. You've got to think that happened on the battlefield as well. They would be, wherever they were, they would be conducting burials on the battlefield. And certainly, a number of chaplains, I have seen records, a number of chaplains keeping detailed records about who was buried where, so that after the war, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission would know where to go and look. And you think about famous chaplains such as Leslie Skinner with the Sherwood Rangers. He wouldn't allow any of the soldiers. So when a tank was brewed up and soldiers died in a tank, he made sure it was his role to go into that tank to recover that body or do whatever he could, because it was about dignity and death. And he really wanted to ensure that. And he would meticulously record his records are there of each death and who they were and where they died and how they died, so that that could be recorded going forward. I think depends on the field, but you think about the amount of burials that some chaplains must have undertaken. That must have been a toll on their mental health. It might not be
absolutely, especially, you know, you mentioned it there, you know, with units like the Sherwood Rangers, where, you know, if a tank's hit, the guys inside can often be in a very, very bad condition when eventually the tank stops burning effectively, you know. And I imagine, you know, his role in doing that would have been to save the other guys in the unit, you know, the torture of seeing their friends and colleagues, you know, in such a bad way. And like you said, you know, putting themselves through that every single time, you know, is a hell of a toll to take on the soul. And I guess at times it must have really tested their religion as well, because, you know, they're thinking, you know, how can this happen? I guess if that's sort of the right term. And when you're research, did you ever undercount any chaplains who sort of not questioned their religion or backtracked on it, but did you ever in diaries and things them sort of question why this was happening and why it must go on and things like that?
I think I have read on in a number of accounts that question, but I think that more manifests itself after the war.
Yeah,
because I think as they're involved in battle and they're involved in the day to day activity, they don't have that time to contemplate and consider. They had chaplain hour, and the chaplains did get together to support each other. But I think it's only on reflection after the war had ended
that
some questioned their religion, and some stopped being chaplains, and some stopped being reverends because of what they had seen. And that had a big impact on their lives. But there's certainly questions in some of the records I've seen where they've said, why is this allowed to happen?
Yeah.
But I think more it was about that dignity and death. And it's about making sure that no matter who you were, you got that dignity. And that was recorded so that your relatives would know what happened.
Absolutely. Ian, we briefly spoke before the podcast started about topics that we wanted to cover. And I think sort of while we're on the topic of dignity and potentially questioning faith, I want to sort of talk about Belson, because you mentioned that it was something that you wanted to talk about. And I think it's a really interesting place. My dad was based in Germany, and we lived about 5 miles, I think, maybe less from where Bergen-Belsen concentration camp was. So we used to drive past it sort of regularly as a kid. I think at the time I was too sort of young, I was only about 10 or 11, to sort of understand the significance of the place and why it was such a hellhole, effectively. But obviously, as I've got older and researched it myself and learned a bit more about it, obviously it comes a lot more into light. So when obviously the British went into Belsen, I imagine they would have had chaplains with them at the time. How did they confront that situation when they came across such a pit of hell almost?
I think that it was shocking to all, not just, yeah. And I think we have to recognize it was shocking to all. We have to think about the numbers, and the numbers I believe were in excess of somewhere between 50 and 80,000 prisoners, more than that perhaps, in Belsen. Yeah. When the British entered, there were piles and piles of bodies that were unburied. Mm. 10,000 dead, 20,000 dead. And I think that the padres and chaplains that were involved, it must have really stretched and tested their religious and their belief in faith. But I know from what I've read, especially from the likes of Father Michael Morrison and Reverend T.J. Stretch and Rabbi Hardman, that they just wanted to go in and do the best they could and help those that had survived. I mean, it's certainly, I think what's quite harrowing in all of this is you listen to Reverend Stretch, and he was there. He arrived at Belsen about 8 days into Belsen being discovered. And he said in an interview, never in my life have I seen such damnable ghastliness. This morning we buried over 5,000 bodies. We don't know who they are. As you can see behind me, there is a pit which will contain another 5,000 bodies. There are two other pits like this. All these deaths have been caused by systematic starvation and typhus and disease. And for that to be such a powerful statement.
Absolutely.
You have to think that did they become immune or numb to these constant burials? And you talk about people like Rabbi Hardman who arrived. And he talked about giving comfort to the survivors, about undertaking prayer about, and we talked about dignity in death. One of the things he tried to persuade the army bulldozer drivers to do, who were, it sounds really bad, bulldozing bodies into these pits.
It sounds awful, but it's ultimately it's the only way you could do it.
Yeah, but what he was trying to do was give them some kind of dignity.
Yeah,
they might have suffered badly, but at least give them dignity in death. And he later, in one of his letters later about his experience in camp, he wrote, "Towards me came what seemed to be the remnants of a Holocaust, a staggering mass of blackened skin and bones held together somehow with filthy rags. In my head, my God, the dead walks, I cried aloud, but I did not recognize my voice." And I think that horror lives with people. That horror is what really, and how did these chaplains that served at Bergen-Belsen, that went through not just the horror of all these burials, but having to deal with those that were starving, that were dying on a daily basis. You've got to remember, they didn't come in, it wasn't instantly cured. Yeah. People were still dying, no matter what food or medicine they got in them, they were still dying. And he said in a recording that I've heard, I didn't lose my faith. But some of the words of the prayers I said in Belsen stuck in my throat. I couldn't understand how the God I worship could permit this. And that comes back to the question you asked about that doubt. And I think it's really important that they were asking those questions.
Yeah.
And I think Belsen, as with Auschwitz, as with other camps that they went in, really did raise that question.
No, absolutely. And I mean, having, you know, watched the footage and seen pictures, I don't think they justify, but show it in the detail that obviously these guys would have seen it in. I think the almost the casualness of what the chaplain said, what you said earlier, you know, there's 5,000 in this pit, there's 5,000 in that pit. That's a staggering amount of dead bodies to be putting into a pit. But like you said, is it, you know, after sort of 6 or 7 days of being there, you sort of, I imagine you would become sort of numb to it. Your body's mechanism, you know, defense mechanism to that would be to try to shut out the shut it out and try to protect your soul almost as much as it can. And it's deeply disturbing and deeply sad for, especially, you know, for the chaplains and stuff, and, you know, the Jewish rabbi who I imagine were there and really, like, you know, like you said, you know, really tested their faith in those sort of situations.
And I think one of the things that I haven't really looked into yet is how did that affect them in later life?
Yeah.
And that is one of the things that sits in my head, is that they experienced these atrocities of Bergen-Belsen, of the camps in Japan, the camps in the Far East. And there are certainly, even to things like the Reverend Harry Babb, who was a prisoner of war in Burma and the Far East. After the war, he volunteered to stay behind and work with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission to identify all the burials and graves up through the Burma Railway that was built. Yeah. And he spent days helping to try and find the 10,500 or whatever the figure was of those burials. And it's that no matter what was in their head, the things that he'd seen and the burials he had already had to do, it's that constant coming back to, I serve this people, my religion. Yeah. And my faith is about serving these people, both in life and in death.
It's like you said, that's, you know, it's a different sort of, I think it's almost a different sort of time where, you know, people would do all this unselfish stuff. And like you said, you know, to stay behind after the horrors that you've seen in a prisoner of war camp in Burma, to volunteer to stay behind, to keep doing your job is a real testament to the strength mentally. And I think, you know, the physical and spiritual strength of these guys as well, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very much so. And I think that's the thing that comes out of all of this, is their internal strength, their belief, yeah, their internal strength. But also, and I think one of the important things to recognize is they were respected by everybody.
Yeah.
They were respected by men of all ranks. They were their friend. They were seen as someone who could be trusted. They were seen as someone who was there and who was always jolly, even though they might not have been, who was always on the front line, who was doing what they needed to do.
Absolutely. Ian, before we finish, let's, I think, talk about D-Day. I think that's a hot topic and one that a lot of people are obviously interested in for a number of different reasons. So during D-Day, were chaplains landing on the beach initially in the first sort of waves? And if so, what was their role, obviously? Because you tend to only hear stories of, you know, infantrymen and certain engineering units that land on the beaches and do, you know, do the real dirty stuff. But what would a chaplain be doing in the first wave of combat troops on a Normandy beach?
They would be as they landed on the beaches and people were wounded, they would be dealing with the wounded on the beaches. They would mm-hmm. be giving last rites to the dying. They would be ensuring that the wounded were given the care and taken back, and helping the medical staff and the regimental aid posts as they were established. They landed on, they were chaplains involved right from D-Day, the 6th of June onwards. And certainly a number of chaplains, I believe one or two chaplains died on D-Day. One of those was, now you're testing my real knowledge here. Which is, one of those was George Parry, Bill Parry. No, George Parry. Oh gosh, you're testing me. Hang on, let me just get this right. And he was part of the parachute regiment. He parachuted in on the 6th of June. And I think he was one of the youngest chaplains to die. He was only 29, when he died, and he died on the 6th. On the 6th of June, parachuting in. And I think there were more deaths in that period of June to September than at any other point in the war.
Yeah.
And that was the chaplains being right on the front line as the front line moved forward, putting them in really difficult positions. And I think they were there.
No, I mean, It's crazy to me, the idea of a chaplain on D-Day, you know, parachuting into Normandy, just sort of cracking on with his job and, you know, being a almost a support troop, you know, with medical duties, etc. But it's just fascinating. I always find chaplaincy fascinating in war, because, you know, if you said to someone, you know, what do you think of a chaplain, that you would never, they would never ever come to the, oh, well, they'll be a great soldier and a great asset to a military unit in a frontline situation. No one would ever say that, but they are.
And I think that's the thing. I think that's the thing that has to be told. It's that story I'm trying to tell. I'm not trying to do a highbrow book that I'm writing. This is about those men, the role, who they were, the role that they undertake, the important role of them on the front line of helping whoever needed help, and not just spiritual, but being in charge of medical, helping the wounded, stretcher bearing, whatever was needed, they were there to do. Even if it was giving cigarettes out, making cups of tea, it's just the simple things, but the simple things that were important.
Yeah.
And that's through all fields of the war, right from day one to the last day they were involved, right at the front end.
No, I think that's super, Ian. And this conversation's flown by. I mean, we're nearly at, you know, 50 odd minutes already, which just shows, you know, how interesting these sorts of topics are. I won't hold too much more of your time, Ian, and I unfortunately do have to go to work tonight, which is always a drag. But I'd, you know, where can people find you if they want to find out more about the chaplaincy, or if they want to reach out, and, you know, if they have their own stories to tell, where can people find you, and when's the book going to be out? This is sort of your time now to plug your own stuff.
Right. Well, they can find me on Twitter. I'm at Clueless Peg on Twitter. Please, if I tease a plea, and I say this and I put this out regularly, if you have stories of chaplains in your family or chaplains you are aware of, please let me know. And it's not just about Second World War chaplains. I'm quite happy to have other stories as well. It's a big data file that I'm collecting. Please come and talk to me there. The book, I'm hoping it could be out back end of this year, start of next year, is the idea behind the book. My research has slowed down a little due to some other things that are happening, but we are moving on with that. If they want to come and listen to us talk about World War II that is wider than chaplains, I run a Zoom social every other Monday. Find me on Twitter. It's advertised there. It's a community group. You can come and listen in, you can come and talk, you can come and ask questions about any part of war. We do get around to chaplains, but we get around to an awful lot more in that group as well. So yeah, find me on Twitter. That's the best place to come and find me, or through this, if you get any inquiries through this, quite happy for you to forward them on as well. Always happy to talk about chaplains, always happy to talk about conflicts and war and chaplains and conflicts and war. And thank you to you for giving me this time. I could talk about this all night. I can go on. We have literally only tickled the surface of what it goes on here. But thank you so much for inviting me along, giving me this opportunity.
No, it's been superb. What I'll do is I'll link your Twitter into the bio of this, so if people want to check you out, they can. And if you'd be interested, I'd definitely like to get you back on again, and we can go further into this, because that would be interesting. Like you said, we've only just sort of scratched the surface, and after 50 minutes, I'm like, I want to keep going, but I am very conscious of time and things like that. Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, everyone, for staying with us while we had our little break, but we are back now. We will be back with some regular content. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you on the next one. Cheery bye.